You're listening to Mom and Doc Talk, where we talk all things healing pans and pandas with an emphasis on homeopathy.
Hi, I'm Jody, the mom.
And I'm Dr. Barr, the doc, and this is Mom and Doc Talk, where we talk all things healing pans and pandas with a special emphasis on homeopathy. And today we're going to talk about a really important aspect of healing, which is one of those things that homeopathy isn't necessarily the best suited for. There are lots and lots of things that homeopathy can be really effective for, but there are some things that we really need some additional support. And what we're going to do today is interview an expert in one of those areas. So we're very excited to welcome Bree Kurczak, who is an occupational therapist, and she's joining us to talk about her experience with helping kiddos with pans and pandas. So I'm going to read a quick introduction to you so you can just orient yourselves to who Bree is, who's going to be joining us before we dive in to all of the really great information that she's going to share with us. So Bree is a dedicated occupational therapist with a passion for promoting children's health and development. She earned her master's degree from Belmont University in Nashville, Tennessee, and has over 16 years of experience in her field. Bree's expertise extends to various specialized areas, including infant and toddler feeding, pediatric pelvic floor therapy, sensory and motor development, and the relationship between wellness, nutrition, and healthy sleep habits. Currently, Bree operates her own private practice, Flourish Carolina, located in Charlotte, North Carolina. Additionally, she is a proud partner of Curious Fork, a brand committed to empowering parents in fostering a healthy lifestyle and nurturing innate curiosity in children. As a mother, Bree has faced and conquered numerous challenges on her parenting journey, including newborn feeding difficulties, seizures, sleep apnea, and coping with chronic illness. She proudly identifies as a panda's mom and draws upon her resilience and determination, both at home with her two boys and her clinical practice. Bree firmly believes in the transformative power of nutrition, quality sleep, and attention to the nervous system in shaping children's development and overall well-being. Her dedication to children's health and her own experiences as a mother have uniquely equipped her to make a lasting impact on the lives of the young ones she serves. You know, Bree, as I'm just reading through this, I just have to tell everybody that I would have met you at MAPS conference, so the Medical Academy for Pediatric Special Needs, where you were presenting recently. And the reason I didn't actually get to meet you there is because my daughter had just had a tonsillectomy and adenoidectomy, and she wasn't really ready for me to be away yet. She'd had it a week before I would have had to leave for the conference. And so I was 1000% even more alert with the stuff that you were talking about, because I was just like, this is so relevant to the life that I've just had. Because I also, you talked about oral restrictions. My daughter had one really, really bad oral restriction when she was born. I had to work with a lactation consultant to help with feeding issues when she was young. And then she was born with enlarged tonsils and adenoids. She snored in the hospital, like hours after she was born, she was snoring. So this is one of those things where, you know, I have to bring this up because homeopathy can help with enlargement of tonsils and adenoids in some cases. My daughter's was a case it could not help with. She was born with it. It wasn't related to inflammation. It wasn't related to illness. She was just born with way too large tonsils and adenoids, 100% blockage. And so she would stop breathing in the middle of the night and everything. So as a mother, I was very excited to hear what you were talking about. And then as a PANS provider, I was extra excited to hear what you're talking about, because again, there are certain things that homeopathy can't help with. And a lot of the stuff you talked about fits into that category. So welcome. I'm so excited to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So let's go ahead and get started. Tell us a little bit more about yourself, you know, beyond what I just shared in your bio and why you do what you do.
Yeah. So I always kind of joke that I'm a professional why asker. My whole life, I've always, you know, followed everything up with, but why? And so I've been a therapist for over 16 years, and the majority of it, 14 of the 16 in pediatrics. And I knew once I went to OT school to become a pediatric provider and, you know, dabbled in the ICU and rehab and things like that, but knew once I got into peds, I was never leaving it. And I quickly just fell in love with the feeding side of things because, you know, parents are doing this 3 to 6 times a day. And I realized, gosh, this is such a burden. This is so stressful when these kids are coming in with feeding struggles. It creates a damper on the whole family. And so I, you know, jumped into the sensory side of feeding, and we're building smiley faces and we're you know, doing all the Pinterest ideas of getting, you know, ways to get kids to eat. And I just kept thinking, there's an entire GI tract being missed beyond just the mouth. And so I kind of made a left turn and went into pelvic floor and became trained in pediatric pelvic floor, realizing, wow, constipation is a big problem and this is part of it. And so kind of worked my way back up the GI tract. I'm going, okay, the feeding and the constipation, like this goes hand in hand. And then I really started seeing, you know, gosh, the behaviors are coming along with this, the nervous system dysregulation. These kids have ongoing stomach aches that parents aren't even aware. They're not even complaining that their stomach hurts, or, you know, I'm doing a feeding evaluation and they're doing a hard swallow with a blink. And I'm going, do they do this every time they swallow? And parents are like, oh, I don't know. I haven't noticed it because it's been the norm for them. So I really started, you know, trying to put the pieces together of, gosh, sleep plays into this, tongue placement plays into this. And so I just kept going. I'm like a serial, you know, continuing ed course taker. Like I just love to learn and put these dots together. And, you know, I finally realized you can't have one piece without the other. And so after years of additional courses in training and realizing, wow, these kids don't know how to breathe. Their tongue placement, whether it's because of a tongue tie and oral restrictions or low tone, and they just don't have good strength. They're open mouth breathing. Well, their open mouth breathing then can enlarge the tonsils and adenoids and create ongoing sickness. Then that can create, you know, feeding difficulties. That then creates gut dysbiosis. So the dominoes just kept falling. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, this longing to keep learning and putting dots together kind of landed me in an area that, you know, other therapists are definitely merging into. But I love getting these hard cases where parents are saying, oh no, we've already done feeding therapy. Or, oh no, we've already done traditional OT. And I'm sitting here going, but the sensory work isn't working if we're not breathing. If we're not breathing correctly, we're not eating, pooping, and sleeping correctly. And then the cycle just continues.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you taught recently at a conference, like I spoke about, where you and I, our paths would have crossed. We virtually crossed. You taught that there's a lot of myths about eating that are especially harmful in pandas families, which is where a lot of things like really set like the bells off for me. Cause I was like, oh my gosh, you're talking about all of these kids who have ARFID and all of the ways that they are given maybe some bad advice that could actually in some ways be harmful. Like that's one of the things that's so we just need to acknowledge, right? For pandas families, some of the typical recommendations that you would offer are not going to work and or could even be harmful given the underlying factors that are going on in the avoidant restrictive food intake. So you talked about a lot of myths that are especially harmful in these families. What are the myths that you really see?
So, I mean, I've even experienced this as a panda's mom, you know, the things that people have said, oh, you're just a helicopter mom, or, oh, it's a behavior problem, or, oh, it's this. And I've turned around and I buy books for them and I drop them off at the front desk of their office to say, do me a favor, learn, save the other people. You know, a lot of times OTs, we're sometimes the first line of defense for families, right? If their kiddo has had chronic illness or has had ongoing issues, they've probably been in OT at some point. And that's where I feel like, you know, if our profession, occupational, physical, speech therapist, if we really can have pandas awareness, we could be so helpful in the first line with these kids. And so I really thought as a provider, I knew a lot about PANS. I have a book in my office about it. I've gotten kids that, you know, they come in with their sudden onset of picky eating. And the day that my own son looked at me and said, I don't eat broccoli that's cooked longer than 15 minutes. I dropped the pan. I turned around and I was like, there it is. There's the first. And we had all of the other check marks. And I was just, you know, in the background and praying as a feeding therapist, like, please don't let us go down the feeding piece. And he said it. And I'm like, there it is. And so we as therapists, you know, we hear this all the time and these families come in and it's been great, you know, as a provider learning about it because I've been able to signal some of the medical questions, right? Any recent sickness? Has this been an abrupt onset? Was this, oh, you know, yeah, they were kind of picky as a toddler and then it just worsened and now we're down to four foods. And so, you know, parents are always given, I always say it's well-intended. It's well-meant by family, friends, pediatricians, doctors. But, you know, the biggest one, oh, they'll grow out of it. It's just a phase. Yep. If A phase to me is, oh yeah, we're just really sick of broccoli and cauliflower, but we're going to jump to another vegetable. Or mom, if you make another turkey burger, I cannot eat another one, but I'm going to eat chicken. I'm going to eat beef. Whatever your dietary, you know, habits and preferences are within the family, that's fine. I always meet families where they're at. But if we are dropping food groups as a whole, or we went from, you know, I always have families create a list. What were their preferred foods, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago? What did they eat as a toddler? What kind of history do they have, you know, early on? If we had breast and bottle feeding dysfunction, that's not even a red flag. That's a brick wall. Like, that's a problem. And then I'm looking, is it really problem feeding versus picky eating? So, you know, the myth of, oh, they'll grow out of it, it's just a phase. Is it really just a phase? When you're giving that snapshot to the pediatrician or GI doctor, that's just right now. How long has this quote phase been going on? Or if this has been going on for years, versus they just woke up yesterday and we've eliminated 10 foods off of our list. Either both of them are a problem. You know, I often hear like, well, they're just picky. I actually cringe at those words. And with Curious Work, I'm on a mission to get rid of picky eating. We wouldn't dare in front of people call our kid a slow runner, or, oh, they're just really bad at math, or they're just really not a good piano player. But for some reason, we're okay to say they're very picky. And I think it's so demeaning because it puts a behavioral context on that. Like, this child is choosing to be picky when no one's investigated what the problem is. So I always say it's unfair to call someone a picky eater until you've proven to me that they're not a problem feeder. And that problem could be in the mouth, in the belly. It could be a lot of things, but it's kind of my rule of my room. You can't call them a picky eater until we've proven otherwise. And then, you know, a lot of doctors, I've heard, oh, well, they won't starve. They can go to bed hungry a time or two. That one, I had a family who proudly walked in. We didn't even make it a quarter of the way through my evaluation. I sent them as a direct admission. They were on day six of standing their ground. Their daughter was going to eat what they served, or she wasn't going to eat. She came in as gray as my clinic walls, and she was so dehydrated and so sick. And they're wonderful parents. They meant well, but it was their doctor's advice told them, you know what, serve her what your family is going to eat. And if she doesn't eat it, that's that. And I spent my time giving them some education on, you know, at night, our body is healing. Our body is repairing. Our engine is resting. And if we are going to bed hungry, we are messing up not only our digestion, we're messing up our nervous system, being able to regulate and do the job that our body needs to do at night. And we're telling our body, just shut it off, ignore it, because we're not getting that need met. We wouldn't do that with anything else. We wouldn't stop bathing our child. We wouldn't stop any other ADL, but yet it becomes this power, you know, this power struggle and this game. And so I really try, those are my three big myths right off the bat of, you know, they'll grow out of it. Is it just a phase? They won't starve. And, you know, they're just being picky. It's behavioral. And I really try to prove that. I mean, I always joke that I buy the good expensive Kleenexes in the clinic, because I oftentimes have parents that have no idea that their child's tonsils are huge. They have no idea that their kid's bowel movements are once every 5-7 days. Because in these older kiddos, when you're not wiping their bottoms, you don't know what their bowel habits are like. They don't talk about it. So they don't know what's dysfunctional or abnormal until I start them on a path of investigation.
Yeah. I'm so grateful that you brought up all of those points about the kids will starve. Like, I was so grateful. I say that in every professional talk that I give, just to make sure people really fully understand that they will absolutely starve. And that is one reason that we don't do restrictive diets or like prescribed diets for PANS PANDAS kids, because their OCD and their ARFID can be so strong that the prescribed diets can make it worse. It can make some of their health anxieties and their fears substantially worse. And if you just try to enforce it on them, they will absolutely end up in the hospital because they will starve before they will eat it, because to them, it is a bigger threat to eat the thing than to not eat. So I really appreciate as well the context that I had never really thought of it as calling somebody a picky eater, as labeling it as a behavioral problem. I feel like there's probably a lot of parents who will use it almost like they're defending their child and just saying, this is just how they are. And so I appreciate that context, that something that can feel like it's really supportive can inadvertently be labeling somebody as a problem, or even if it's not labeling, even if people don't really intend it that way, that it's still ignoring an underlying factor that is contributing to it, and just saying, this is just how they are, instead of like, is there a way that we can support them through this? So I really appreciate you bringing those up.
I think it's such a, you know, as we near the holidays, it opens the table for grandma and auntie and uncle and everyone to weigh in. And I'm sitting here going, well, goodness, if your child is struggling with math or a sport, we're not going to bring that up at the dinner table, right? We're just not at Thanksgiving or Christmas. And, you know, I just hug the parents that are coming in through the holidays, because it's so hard. And I really try to empower those parents and say, that is not a discussion to have A, in front of your child, and B, to have at the holiday dinner table. Squash it ahead of time. Send a text message. You know what? We are working through Johnny's feeding challenges, and we have a professional that is guiding us, and we are asking that it is not to be discussed during, you know, this holiday or whatever. Squash it from the beginning, because as a you know, Pan's parent, like, we're dealing with enough, and we really don't need the chorus to weigh in. And I know it's well-intended, but to give advice, and I sure don't want my sons to hear things as well. You know, it's just, I think it's another layer of stress that is not needed. So I really, really encourage parents, set the stage of what is okay to be discussed and isn't, just as like, you know what, we might move it to the politics like category. Nope, we're not discussing it at the holiday dinner table. And I think that really gives parents, you know, it empowers them to just say, okay, we don't have to talk about it for this, you know, couple hour moment. And it gives them a breather, because people have no idea. We're dealing with enough.
I love that you just answered my question without it even being asked, because that's such a hard point. And it makes so much sense that it's okay for us as parents to just set that boundary.
Yep.
And just say, nope, like, we don't have to discuss it. And man, it just, even hearing you say that, like, it like feels like it takes stress away, right? Because I just don't have to. I don't have to go into all of the explaining. I just set that boundary and then we're done with it.
Yeah. When my oldest was three, we went to a birthday party and we were in the throes of dietary eliminations. We were down to under 20 tolerated foods without reactions. And I'll never forget, I carried in the dreaded polka dot backpack and I was just waiting. Like, I would sit there at these parties just waiting for someone to say something. And I whipped out the black bean quinoa burger, strawberries, and cucumber slices while everyone else was eating Papa John's and regular cupcakes and all the things. And a mom looked at me and said, oh, you must be that mom. And I could barely even talk about it without getting choked up. I packed up the backpack, the lunchbox. I looked at my girlfriend whose party it was. I was like, we've got to go. And I just stopped in the car. I wanted to go in and shake the woman to say, that mom, I wish I wasn't this mom. I would die for my child to be eating the Papa John's. You have no idea at 4 in the morning that I'm getting up to prepare alternative pizza swaps and cupcake swaps. And, you know, and she didn't know. I know, you know, she didn't know, but I hope it was a moment of my reaction. I hope it made her pause to just, you have no idea what people are going through. And I think empowering parents to set the tone when it comes to feeding, when it's going to be discussed and who it's going to be discussed with. It's a hard enough topic. And it's not an open mic night for families. It needs to be set the stage and just say, we are working through this, and this is a very, very challenging topic that we're not going to discuss at X, Y, and Z event.
I'm just going to put it out there that, like, regardless of whether a child has Pan's Pandas or whatever, there's nobody's business what anybody eats, period, anywhere, end of story. Like, we need to stop being judgmental about what anybody chooses to put in their mouths or to feed their children. If we want to feed our children Cheetos and the Papa John's every day, great. Yep. If we want to feed our children black bean veggie burgers and strawberries and cucumbers every day, great. It's nobody's business what anybody eats, period. And there's no reason to judge somebody for making choices for what works for their family too. So absolutely. I'm just gonna put it out there for anybody. We need to just let that go. Food is just food, and it's not something to judge people for.
Right. Mm. Exactly. We're all doing the best that we can.
Yeah, I wish the whole world would receive that, because I am one of those moms too that has had a child from birth that has had feeding issues, allergy issues, everything, with an extremely, extremely limited diet. And it feels so the judgment feels so heavy and uncomfortable. And it's not just from strangers. It's from the people that are right next to us on a regular basis. So it's
because they don't know. They don't know that you're waking up or that you're searching recipes and cookbooks and swaps. And, you know, I always say I'm tired because I'm forward thinking to prevent or to pack and to plan. And what time do I need to wake up and how many grocery, stores do I need to go to, or this brand eliminated this favorite food. Shoot, what are we going to do now? So it's heavy. That is why what really drove me into feeding is because the stress. I mean, before hopping on this call with you guys, I spent 90 minutes with a mom, a dad, and a grandma, you know, going through their kiddo's current diet, and they're on all of these restrictions and helping them expand and swap and add to because they're so limited. And at the end, they were just like, oh my gosh, thank you. This gave us like 40 new things to try. So I love meeting families where they're at. And, you know, when they ask like, oh, well, what do your kids eat? I'm like, leave my kids out of it. They're over here eating asparagus and, you know, spinach salads. But we have our own set of challenges with food as well, right? I wish they could eat the Papa John's and the cupcake without a reaction. So I love to just meet families where they are, because I say to every one of them, I come in and I kind of crouch down and I'm like, you're here because you want help. You are not on the stand. This is not a courtroom. Please don't come in here feeling like ashamed or you're in trouble. I'm here to help you.
Yeah. Beautiful. So as I shared, I learned so much from your presentation about all of the systemic impacts on eating. Like you talked about things from breathing dysfunction to sleep dysfunction, immature oral motor skills, pain, constipation, nutritional deficiency, sensory processing, and all the environmental, behavioral, and parental factors. So like a ton of things that you managed to cram into 45 minutes of a presentation. So I'm going to ask you, I'm going to challenge you to do what you can to replicate as much of that as possible, but for the perspective of Pandas families, I would just love for you to share what you wish that all Pans Pandas parents knew about these things. And if you need me to remind you of any of the things that I listed out that I learned from you or that you talked about, let me know. I'm happy to jog your memory because I know it can.
So I always start all of my evaluations, whether it is, you know, a kiddo that has the diagnosis or not, in kind of the same systemic order. They think they're coming in with my kid has a behavior problem or a sensory, you know, it's a sensory based problem with feeding, and that's why they're not. So I always say I leave the three main categories of sensory based feeding, their environment, and then behavior. I leave those last, which is funny because I have parents come in with a food log and they're ready to like dive in on what sensory problem their child has. I start at the beginning. So, you know, kiddos with a PANS diagnosis, I'm still looking at, do they have an oral motor problem? Is their tongue able to move in all quadrants? The amount of mis or undiagnosed tongue ties and lip ties and cheek ties that I see, it's everywhere. I mean, the amount of babies that I'm seeing that are restricted, it's just doubling. And so I'm looking right off the bat, can they move their tongue to be able to touch their back molar? Can they clear food out of their cheek? Can they mobilize the food properly? If they can't, that's equating to you're running a marathon in high heels. You could probably still do it, but it's not the right equipment. So then,
well, and once you add in like the Pans Panda stuff too, it's just like, so the things that are potentially have been there since birth that they have been working through, cup is full. You can't do it anymore.
Yes. And so then you add in the OCD, then you add in the ARFID, you add in those pieces, and out of nowhere, we've shrunk down and feeding has been, you know, it could have always been maybe a problem or a topic of stress, right? In the chronic illness kiddos, 99% of the time it's a problem. And so then you add in the emotional, the psychological part of feeding, and it just implodes. So the other side of it is sleep. The amount of families that have no parents have no clue. Well, like my kid's in their bedroom and the door's shut and they don't come out. So they must be sleeping. When I send them down the path of we're going to investigate, you're going to go in over a 2-week time span and we're checking out what position are they in? Is their mouth open or closed? Are they snoring? Are they grinding their teeth? Are they upside down? I want parents that are like, oh my gosh, they've fallen out of their bed and I had no clue. So, you know, a lot of times they're like, oh no, we don't have a sleep problem. I'm like, well, we're going to prove that. I need proof that we don't have one. So again, these kiddos, you know, the separation anxiety and the stress of going to bed, they're getting their nervous system so revved. So that's part of it. Then if we have an actual mechanical issue that's preventing good, deep quality sleep with breathing, well, great. Now we have another, like now we've just layered on top of it. So I'm huge on investigating the sleep piece. So, you know, to tell parents, go in and check on your kid. You know, if you wake up at midnight and happen to use the restroom, go in and check on them. What position are they in? Are they sweating profusely? Again, parents will be like, no, they're not hot. Our house is really cool at night. No, what's happening to their body? Are they mouth breathing, which is revving their engine, and they are hot? Do they have co-infections and other things going on that could be causing nighttime sweating? So let's get data and information of what is happening in their sleep. You don't know that you're not getting good quality sleep until you get a night of quality sleep. And I'll have kiddos that they come in and they're like, oh my gosh, Miss Bree, like, I didn't know I was so tired. You know, parents will say, yeah, I see daytime yawning, or the opposite. Oh no, they're hyper all day long. I'm like, because they're tired. They're hyper because they're tired. Looking at, you know, constipation. Again, if we're not wiping their bottoms, we don't know what their bowel habits look like. So I teach all kiddos that are old enough to understand the Bristol stool scale, standardized. It's easy to look at. And for families to just identify, you know, I always love the like 10-year-old boys that come in, they're stressed out, their head down. And I start off our session. I'm like, so do you know why you're here today? I don't know. My mom made me come. I have something about me at my eating. I said, well, guess what? We're going to talk about food, but first we're going to talk about poop. And their ears perk up and then they kind of snicker. And it's like, and we're going to talk about farts and we're going to talk about poopy pants and all the things. And once I break the ice, then they're like, okay, this girl might be a kind of okay, because she's talking about farting and pooping. But we have to know, you know, it's so embarrassing. And I always say to them, I'm like, do you know who in this room poops? And I raise my hand, and the parent, I'll kind of nudge them to raise their hand. I'm like, we all do it. And we have to talk about it, because what's happening in our bellies and what's coming out into the toilet, like, we have to know what's going on in our body to know how to help it. You know, nighttime wedding and enuresis, like, these kiddos, they're ashamed. They're not going to camp because of it. They're not going on sleepovers. And so, you know, getting kids to understand, this is not a choice. This isn't a behavior problem. Your mom's putting an alarm on you and a wet pad and taking you to the bathroom. I always say your brain and your bowels and your bladder may not be connecting. They might be, you know, different places having a party at night. And so reducing that, you're the problem. Your bowels are the problem, and just helping them understand this is happening at night, and you're not in control of this. You know, looking at pain, kids will open up and say like, oh yeah, I have stomach aches. And the parents look like, oh my gosh, I swear I know my kid, and I swear I'm their parent. And it's the first time they're hearing it. But again, you don't know to speak up about something if that's their norm, if that's their baseline. I get kids all the time that are, you know, they're constipated. They have a KUB x-ray done and they're full of stool. And the parents are like, I had no idea. So, you know, I'll start asking them, does it hurt when you swallow X, Y, and Z type of foods? Or does it hurt when you go to the bathroom? Do you have to push your poop out? And they really start opening up, and we can identify where's the breakdown. If you're not chewing your food correctly and swallowing prematurely, you're going to have a digestive problem. You're going to have some constipation. That creates pain, that backs you up, that limits diet. And then we go into typically carbs and sugar, and we're craving all non-nutritious food. So then we're looking at kiddos, what does their nutrition status look like? Most of these kiddos, when, you know, we're looking into ARFID and the OCD is so high, or they already had a limited diet heading into this, their nutrition is typically suffering. You know, their nutrition levels are taking a hit. So I'm not a big one. When families come in already on dietary restrictions or accommodations, again, I meet them where they're at, but I tell them walking out of my room, let's not change anything until you have some data points, like get some baseline labs. Most pediatricians will run, you know, what does their iron look like? What is their zinc, their magnesium, their vitamin D? Just getting some baseline, because I think that's a good way for parents and for kids old enough to understand. You know, I'll say, well, mom has to go to the gas station to put gas in the car so she can drive you places. We've got to put nutrition in our body to keep our body running just like a car. So if they understand, wow, I'm not, you know, I'm deficient in this area, or I'm overloaded in this area, I'll sit down with a list of foods and, you know, together say, what are we going to work on? How can we problem solve this together? And so once by the time I've gotten really through those five main topics, parents are now at a place where they're like, oh gosh, so maybe this isn't sensory, or maybe this isn't just behavior, you know, from a PAN standpoint, let's make sure these things weren't going on prior, even if they were unidentified or overlooked. Let's rule those things out before we come at it from an OCD, an RFID, and a behavioral standpoint.
I see some overlap with some of the ways that we have to address things with homeopathy in what you just talked about, in that like your parent can't necessarily come to you as an occupational therapist and say, I want to work on this and this, and like not really, you know, just pick and choose the things that they want to work on, right? You have to share all of the things that are going on in order to be effective, and then look at the deeper underlying cause. I also love that the things that people will come in that are, they're concerned about, the sensory stuff, the behavioral stuff, and even the constipation, that those are things that homeopathy can help with, the sensory sensitivity, the behavioral aspect, and the any dynamic aspects to constipation that homeopathy can help with. Same thing with anything that's contributing to like a functional nutritional deficiency, not a frank nutritional deficiency, which is always important to figure out where you're at. So this is where like I just resonated so much with what you're talking about and how complementary it is, because this is also, you know, I know Jody's got dying to say something, so I'm going to get this out. I promise, Jody, that this could be something that for people who might be struggling with who've maybe already been using homeopathy for a while and seeing certain aspects of like feeding or breathing or sleep or constipation not being moved the way that we expect it to, where other aspects are improving with homeopathy. Maybe there's one of these functional, like just like basic things that they haven't been addressed, you know, that they might have something that's limiting or giving them oral restrictions, that has the breathing dysfunction. They might be like my daughter who just had big tonsils and huge adenoids and was not like homeopathy was never going to address them. And so we had to get something done about them because it was just going to cause more problems for not. So
I always say breathing is number one. If you're not breathing, you're not doing anything correct. You're not eating correctly. You're not sleeping correctly. You're not pooping correctly. Nothing. So breathing. But I also see, you know, that ENTs are very quick to take tonsils and adenoids that, okay, wait, we have no tongue mobility to get to the roof of the mouth for lip closure to teach nasal breathing, right? So I think it's important finding someone who's looking at the big picture and helping you piece this together in what order, because you go and take the tonsils. Well, that was kind of the pillow for your tongue. So does your tongue have stability and mobility to then you know, be in the correct place, which is up in the roof of the mouth.
I think this is also interesting. I think so many moms are going to be doing exactly what I'm doing right now. I'm just like taking all of this in because it makes so much sense to me that because you're speaking to my household, every like husband, both daughters have been through speech therapy, and it seems like it would have made a whole lot of sense while going through homeopathy. Homeopathy helped with a lot of stuff, but also as you're talking, I'm like, oh, we still have a little bit of this or a little bit of that. And could looking at it from a different kind of viewpoint been beneficial? And so joining these two things together, I would imagine would be so helpful because there's things in my home that I'm thinking about now that like, could it be something be a nutritional deficiency? Could it be that we need to do more speech therapy to deal with the tongue movement issues that we had? So this is all so interesting to me. So when, as parents, when should we seek occupational therapy to support our children's recovery from PANS, PANDAS, and what can we expect it to help with?
I say go. When you are, I love for parents to be proactive, right? You know, if they're kind of being pushed to the side and like, oh, you know, they'll grow out of it, or oh, it's just a phase, or all of the things, you know, finding a therapist that understands PANS and, you know, can really meet the kiddo where they're at, where it's like, okay, if you are doing some myofunctional therapy and really working on tongue placement and breathing, that's hard. And it could be a motor planning issue. And then they shut down and then they run away from the table. It's finding a therapist that will meet you where you're at and understands what is happening to them. They're anxious, they're stressed, they go into fight or flight. They cannot function at that point. And just either we shut down, we might get aggressive. You know, we deal with that in my own son. And so I think therapy, I'm always a huge proponent of just being proactive and go. When your gut feeling as a mom or dad, like when you have that feeling, go. Let a professional, let a specialist, not just a generalist, tell you if tongue mobility is a problem, if the constipation and sleep piece is a problem. So I think oftentimes, you know, we wait until, okay, well, they're in a flare and now we need immediate help, but that might not be the right time because we may not get the participation out of them that we would get otherwise. So I think, you know, for my own son, we didn't start any cognitive behavioral therapy until we had a wrap on things because he was so flared that I was not taking him to sit there and work with a play therapist that, you know, it was over his head. He was not in a place to receive it. And so I think OT can be the same thing. You know, if you have questions and you have these red flags, as I was listing off that, you know, kind of the checklist, if you're going, wow, they were a difficult breast or bottle feeder. And man, we have had some feeding issues and that rolled into a PANS diagnosis. Go get an evaluation. Don't wait. I also think it's completely appropriate. And I have kiddos on my caseload right now that, you know, when they're flaring, we pause and they come back when we're in a good place. You know, I had one today that was having a very hard morning and shows up. I see this guy in my home because he's much more comfortable and familiar with my house. And he shows up and mom's like, I dosed him before we got here. And I don't know how this is going to go. And I said, we're going to roll with it. And he had a fantastic session. So I think understanding the diagnosis and meeting these kids, really any diagnosis. I tell parents, you're kind of coming in a manila envelope. You can tell me what you've been diagnosed with, but I'm looking on ways to help you as a whole family and help the child versus a specific label.
Fantastic. So I'm curious if occupational therapy is something that will help kids with like their handwriting and other motor skill difficulties when they're in a flare. I mean, you sort of touched on not being able to receive it, but is there anything that it can help with when they're in a flare?
I think too, looking at their history, right? Are these kiddos that have been, you know, in years of therapy? Then I say, if you have been in years and years of therapy and your goals just keep changing, are we getting to the root problem? I'm a big believer in, you know, if we're going to therapy for sensory work and we go on Wednesdays at 3 o'clock, that's like telling a diabetic, only take your insulin on Wednesdays at 3 o'clock. Like, what are we doing to support their nervous system and their sensory systems outside? And going back to homeopathy from a susceptibility, you know, standpoint and a chronic illness standpoint. So I think the terms, you know, sensory processing disorder and fine motor delay, and we throw those around as an OT because that's the core of our training. That's what we learn to do and to manage. So I go to, were these kiddos struggling before diagnosis or before being in a flare? Then absolutely. Knowing the services and the recommendations might need to change, right? We might have been working on handwriting and fine motor strength and coordination, but then I'm looking whole body. Do they have whole body coordination? Are they breathing correctly? What do their primitive reflexes look like? If those are off, we're going to have fine motor challenges. Then you add a flare in, we're really going to have them. So my thing of when, you know, working with kiddos in a flare, I'm band-aiding. I'm giving them whatever they need in that moment to simplify and reduce stress. If writing, and my own son experienced that, where it was writing with math. So he would do math verbally, but the minute you asked him, and he knew the math, but to write it. And so, you know, I really had to pull out my OT strategies, and I'm writing recommendations on popsicle sticks for communication and, you know, apologies, but giving him the tools to say when he's losing it in the classroom, he might not be able to take this popsicle stick. He's going to snap it. And he did. But it's also what things will work in that moment. And that I think is forever changing. So empowering parents to find a therapist who gets it and is willing to ebb and flow. And when you're in a good place, great, you don't need them. There's too many harsh rules, in my opinion, of like starting therapy, ending therapy. I always say, you know, come to me for multiple degrees. Great, we work on this task. There's your associates, you graduated. Okay, we have a new problem. And that might be days, months, or years, but really just meeting them in the need. So I think it can be very beneficial. OT can be very beneficial in a flare if you have a therapist who understands and gets what's going to come along with that flare.
Yeah. I think this is why, like, I feel like the providers that we're meeting that are not only recognizing PANS, and also using that knowledge in their practice. Like when I came across Dr. Barr, I was like, oh my gosh, like this is a unicorn. And it's kind of the same thing with you. It's like, oh, there's people out there. And I think this is one thing that I'm so huge on advocating is I love the fact that you're here talking to us about this, because I can't help but think there are other occupational therapists that are going to hear this type stuff and be willing to receive information from you as opposed to just hearing it from us parents. And this is how, like, over the years, we see this kind of getting a little bigger and a little bigger in providers. Because as you're talking about finding a provider in your area that's, you know, knowledgeable, that was one of our struggles, was the provider was not familiar with PANS. And like, we got to the end of our prescribed sessions and she's like, okay, you're good. Like, nice knowing you. And that was it. And I thought that that was okay. I thought that's where we ended and we were good. So again, I love that you're here and advocating for our children along with us.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I say 4 years ago, I even changed my profile picture on Facebook to celebrate PANS Awareness Day. And, you know, I really thought I knew what it was until I experienced it in my own home. And the day, October 15th, last year, on the 14th, he went to bed fine. And on the 15th, he was not fine. And the first text to a fellow PANS mom, who is a really good friend, I was like, I know what's wrong with him. I'm not, you know, and the amount of times I've said in the last year, I actually haven't been very public about his diagnosis. I just publicly posted about it right the week that I left for MAPS, because I've just, you know, the people that know what's going on, or they know from the outside, I felt a lot of shame and a lot of guilt of like, here I am helping all these kids. And I'm like, you know, a closet fake. Like, I show up to work and I'm changing all these kids' lives and I'm helping these families. And then I'm going home and it's, you know, a nightmare. Or I'm fielding a phone call and I'm in tears because the school is calling. And then I have to slide my clinic door open and here's parents sitting in the waiting room. And, you know, as I started being more open about what was going on, I had a dad one day who was like, do you need a hug? And I said, yes, I do need a hug. I would love a hug. And he gave me a hug. And circle months later, they just called me within the last month. I was treating younger sister and older brother following strep. Bam, just slid down the slide. And they called me and he said, had you not shared that day of what was going on with your son and in tears and asked for a hug, we would have never known. I was their first phone call. I'm like, here are your labs, get to the pediatrician, you know, at least get this ball rolling. And so I said to my PANS mom friend today, this morning, I said, you know, I'm not angry that this fell into our lap. I would love for it to not, PANDAS not be a part of our life. But I said, I think that I was meant to go down this to help other families. And as a provider to say like, no, this is happening in my house too. And this is real. And here are the people that will support you and to connect, you know, to connect families. And so it's like every area that I've worked in or treat families, my own kids have experienced it. And so it's, you know, I never thought professional and personal worlds would collide. And I don't feel angry or why me. I feel like what a gift that, you know, some days I'm like, okay, God, like you don't have to teach me through my kids anymore. Like I've got it. I promise you, you know, and I just bought some books as we're navigating the homeopathy world and getting my husband on board. And you know, I said to a friend, I said, I think that this is going to be the thing that I needed to learn as a mom. And it was one more part of my provider puzzle. And so it's, you know, I think that it's just, you find your crew, you find your people. And I, you know, just hope parents find people that listen and support them and help them. And if they don't, hire and fire, move on, find the next person.
Yeah.
I'm gonna
welcome you to the world of being open and embracing what life has given you. And I hope that your experience has been very much like mine. And it sounds like it has been so far that it is freeing, to both just be able to like, not have to feel like you have to hide anything about your own personal experience. And as you said, you already see what a gift it is that you understand what these kids and what these families are going through in a way that somebody who hasn't experienced it wouldn't. I will tell you right now, we would not be sitting here at all if I hadn't shared my own experience, because that is what Jody has told me was the main reason she trusted me over other homeopaths when she was deciding to explore homeopathy. And it's also okay that it's not always easy. And sometimes you wish it would just be gone, right? So, and the reality is every parent, I think that everybody who is in the PANS PANDAS community gets the opportunity to see all the gifts that come from PANS once things start to settle down. And at the same time, it would be lovely if we could get the gifts in a different way.
Yep.
100%.
We've healed more in the last year, even though it's been the hardest year, mm-hmm. than ever before in my marriage and parenting. And I say, you know, if PANDAS wouldn't have hit us when it did, it's delivered a lot of hardships, but honestly, some of the best gifts. And I don't know that I would have slowed down had this not happened. So
yeah, just makes you see what's important and what really matters. Yeah.
Yep.
I love that you're recognizing that as you're still in it. It took me a long time to get to that and even still have a really hard time talking about it because I know there's so many families that are still struggling and it's hard to talk about, you know, oh, what you're going through is such a blessing, but it really, the life we learned in PANS has completely changed us for the better, everything about our lives.
Yeah.
So I love that you're recognizing that in it.
I almost feel too a little bit, maybe you guys feel this way, of guilt of nearing, you know, healing or being in a good place and, you know, feeling a level of guilt. But I really have spent a lot of time reflecting on that and spinning it into showing families like you can get there, you can go through this. And it's really hard. There were a lot of really hard days and nights, but you can get there. You can get to the other side. And it's finding what works for your family. And in that moment, it's so overwhelming. I say, you know, and I said at MAPS, like our journey into a PANDAS diagnosis, I literally felt like I was laying flagstone in a garden, like 8 years of chronic illness, mold toxicity, a Lyme diagnosis, all of the things that I sat at my kitchen island the next day the next week, that Friday, the 21st, going, I know what's wrong with my kid. And this is how we've gotten here. It was almost a light bulb moment for me of like, how did this actually not happen sooner? You know, or all the soft markers and all the things that, you know, we had seen that led us there. So, you know, getting parents to understand, like, it's scary, it's overwhelming, but find your people and find, you know, key players that will support you and help you unpack. I always say you don't come with this diagnosis with a piece of luggage. You came with like the store of luggage brands where you've got like all the bags to unpack, and find providers that are willing to help you through that, who believe you. And you don't, you know, the amount of times I've said, like, I'm not crazy, I'm not making this up, I can't even count them. It's been so many. So
speaking of finding providers, are there places that people can find PANS PANDAS literate occupational therapists, or are there special things that they should share with their occupational therapist to help them learn more to become more PANS PANDAS literate?
I mean, obviously your Facebook group, I send, you know, a lot of therapists that I've connected with are like, how have you learned about this? I'm like, well, unfortunately I've learned through my boys and, you know, they've made me learn as a mom. But really getting the therapist, you know, provide, there are plenty of books out there now. There are plenty of things that therapists can read. I mean, my son's first grade teacher last year spent Christmas break reading Nancy O'Hara's book on PANS PANDAS, demystifying it. And like, she didn't have to do that. She wasn't paid to do that, but chose to do it to learn about it. So I think, you know, if you find a therapist that's maybe they don't know about it or enough about it yet, give them resources that have helped you as a parent and encourage them to learn together. You know, there are plenty of Facebook groups. There are plenty. And even if it's their, you know, a provider that's not understanding of homeopathy, get on there and read. Other parents are posting things. And the amount of times that I spend at night scrolling and just reading and researching myself from a mom perspective has helped me professionally. So, you know, I think that it's something that I hope more therapists come around to. I used to teach at the collegiate level. I still go back and do a feeding lecture, and I share openly. This last year, I shared about Cohen's situation. And I would love to get to a place of teaching other therapists this. And, you know, I sit and I'm like, how do I bottle up everything that I've experienced as a parent and put that into teaching OTs? That's on the docket at some point. But I think just getting therapists, you know, even if they're not a mom or a dad, but getting them to learn from the same resources, I think is a beautiful thing if they're open to it.
And are they, and that, kind of on that note, are there any special considerations that OTs should kind of keep in mind when they're working with PANS and PANDAS kiddos?
I mean, I just go back again to the basic, meet them where they are in that moment, in that day, right? Meet the parents where they are. I think understanding the diagnosis will help you understand flares, and, you know, your recommendations given to that set of parents last week may be very different next month, but find out, you know, I like to touch base with my parents. How are you feeling? What do you need today? What, you know, meeting them where they are right then, because that can be ever changing. I'm very, very accessible as a therapist. I was out of the country last week celebrating 10 years of marriage. And my husband was like, put your phone away. And I'm like, but one more text, one more email. I'm walking through parents, you know, I'm FaceTiming them from Mexico for a post-phrenectomy, you know, wound care assessment. So, you know, just find your therapists that are willing to learn. I say, like, you know, I've done this for 16 years, but I know nothing. I still learn every day, all day. So, you know, if you find a good therapist that you connect with, give them the resources that have helped you as a parent. They'll be much better for it, and they'll help another family.
I'm going to throw one more thing in there, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, because I'm obviously not an occupational therapist, but like I will say with like psychotherapy, you can't out therapy inflammation. And so I think just remembering that there's an inflammatory component to it, that, and like we talked at the beginning, that you can have these things that are underlying functional problems or structural problems that need to be addressed that didn't really come to the forefront until the inflammation made it so that they couldn't work around the functional and structural problems. So just remember, you can't out therapy inflammation.
You know, and I'll get a kid out of that when they come in for that. And we're in a flare, we're having a really off day, and mom's like, we should have canceled. And I thought about it. I'm like, no, I get them on the mat, I get them on the floor, and we'll just breathe. Like, most kids do not know how to breathe. And I think that is such a technique of just mindfulness and breathing that can really help them in all aspects. So taking it back to the basics, let's just be mindful of where is our body. You know, I do a lot of like, how full or empty is your bucket? And if they need a hug or they need a squeeze, or what do they need? So connecting them with their own body, because, you know, as a parent, on the parent side of it, we want to fix and do, but I need them to be connected with their own body.
Yeah.
And so getting both, you know, the parents and the kiddo to calm down and to reconnect so they can identify what do they need in that moment. That was the biggest thing for me as a mom of, I'm a fixer, and I've been disconnected from my boys because I've been their medical investigator. I've been trying to solve rashes and behaviors and sleep and problems for years. And I threw my hands in the air and said, I can't fix them. I might as well go fix myself and my own years of trauma and therapy and all the things. And that was the moment where I was like, holy crap, I'm not very available and I'm not very connected with them. And that was a very humbling moment. But I look at that now of, it was always just one more email, one more text, hold on a second. But really stopping and seeing what do you need in this moment from me? Because if I'm not available to give it, you're not going to ask for it. And do they even know how to ask?
Yeah. I think
that's one last question. Well, I have one last question for you. I'm sorry, Jody, go ahead.
I was just going to share that I think that's true for so many PANS moms, is that we are in this space where we're really investigating, reading, doing all of the things. And then all of a sudden we're like, I am totally not there.
I would have said like, no, I'm a great mom and I'm so connected. And no, I wasn't, because I was always looking to fix the next thing, or prevent. And instead of just saying, okay, I can't, but I can be here and I can be present. And I think that's been the biggest repair for us, which honestly leaped us into a place of healing that, you know, a year ago I would have been ashamed and angry. Like, how dare you say that? And now it's, I've seen it across our whole family. It's been a beautiful thing.
Nice. So I have one last question that I'm hoping is going to be an easy answer. And if it is not, then I'm going to invite you back, because I know that we're out of time. I'll invite you back to talk about this if it's not an easy answer. So there's a lot of overlap, as I'm sure you're aware, between autism spectrum disorder, PANS, PANDAS. There are people who are diagnosed with ASD who actually have PANS. There are people who have PANS and ASD. And so I'm curious if there's really any difference with working with the kids when they have ASD versus PANS, or if they have both ASD and PANS, or if it's really just goes, if the fundamentals are the same, no matter who it is, and it's just about meeting them where they're at.
I think that is very complex, but I will shorten it in a quick answer, in that I think meeting them where they're at and what they need in that moment, right? If you're just starting out and these kiddos haven't had any services, you know, a lot of times as a therapist, I'm going, okay, let's near a diagnosis. Like, do we need some testing? Like, you know, some families want to go down the testing supplement route. Some families are going to jump right into homeopathy. So normally they're, you know, parents are so overwhelmed. I just stop. No matter the diagnosis, what is the priority? What is it that your kid does not sleep and they are up all night long? Then we need to go and figure out the sleep piece, right? Well, that's complex because that may not be breathing. We can't fix a tongue tie, adenoids, tonsils. Like, you're in for an 18-month journey with retraining that. So it's more of what will get the parents to a place of they can come up for air to breathe. And then I go from there. And I don't feel like that's the same for any two families.
Fair. Very fair. Well, Bree, I can't thank you enough for all of the wonderful information that you've shared. I've seen like 10 light bulbs at least go off with Jody in the conversation. So I know that I was right and that our community needs to hear it. If Jody, who is on the other side, still is like, oh, maybe I need to do this. So not dealing with PANS anymore, but still has some of those things that maybe got worse during PANS because of that inflammation and the cup being overfilled and overflowing. So I'm so grateful that you were willing to take the time to come and join us for this podcast and share your information and your expertise with the community. How can people get in touch with you to learn more about your services, to maybe consult with you, to see if there's something going on that they need to work with their kids? I think you said that there is a way that even if you can't work physically with them, that you could at least help guide them. So like that intermediary when they're maybe don't have a PANS literate occupational therapist, that you could maybe be in between. Tell us how we can get in touch.
So my website, flourishcarolinaot.com, there is a contact me section. That's the easiest way. You can hop on there, submit an inquiry, and myself or my clinical coordinator, Kelly, she is my lifeline and amazing. One of us will reach out and see, you know, what do you need? I do virtual consults. I talk with families all over the place and help them connect the dots or areas to, you know, to look into. I'm trying to up my social media game a little bit on Instagram, same thing, Flourish Carolina OT. And then I recently joined a partnership in the last year with Curious Fork, where we're a brand that we're on a mission to just educate and empower parents. They're exhausted. They want their kids to be nutritionally well, and they want a well-balanced diet. And so we're kind of on a mission to bust the myths around, you know, and the frustration and the hard points. So you'll find me doing silly reels on there. I never imagined being, you know, on Instagram and doing reels and things like that. But we want parents to feel heard and supported and real life. You know, I'm a mom on this side of it too, not just a therapist. So you can reach out that way as well.
Well, fantastic. I really hope that people do reach out so that you can continue to do the good work that you're doing with helping people understand some of these obstacles to healing that they need to address to help their kids have the opportunity to eat well, sleep well, breathe well, all of which are vital for life for anybody and everybody. So thank you for the good work you're doing. Thank you for being an open and proud PANDAS mom and for all of the things that you're doing for the community as a whole.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks.
We hope you found this episode helpful, hopeful, and inspiring. We try to get a new episode out every week. You can make sure you don't miss any by following us on Spotify or subscribing to our channel on YouTube. If you want to connect with us more, join our Facebook group, Homeopathy for PANS and PANDAS, where we have exclusive weekly videos and answer your questions about, you guessed it, homeopathy for PANS and PANDAS throughout the week. If you are already a member, give us a shout out and let us know what you thought about this episode. If you aren't on Facebook and would like to reach us, you can email us at podcast@resiliencenaturopathic.com. Until next time, take care and remember, this won't be forever.